You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works Volume 147A, by Rudolf Steiner, 12 Lectures, translated by Christiana Bryan, entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History. This is Lecture 10, given on the 17th of February, 1918, in Munich. Today it will be my task to move on from the fundamental principles of a spiritual method of observing, recently nurtured here, to spiritual processes, which in one sense lie immediately behind our times and speak so fatefully to our souls. As you can imagine, it is in the context of what spiritual science calls coexisting with forces streaming from the so-called dead into the realm in which we ourselves live during our incarnation. It is in this shared existence that we can observe in all its dynamism precisely what spiritually underlies these grueling times. However, present-day people barely look for the spiritual background to existence. This non-seeking for the spiritual background to existence is far more closely intertwined than you may think with the baleful cataclysm that has engulfed humanity. I have drawn attention to the time that can be designated the last third of the 19th century, during which, in contrast with earlier times spans, humankind as a whole underwent mighty, all-encompassing changes in its evolution. I have often referred to the end of the 1870s as a decisive incision into human evolution. You have to admit that only very few among present-day people realize how fundamentally different spiritual life has been since the end of the 1870s, compared with all that went before it. I'd like to say, humanity has secured far too little distance to be in a position to notice this. You can only really see something of this kind if you can discern its differences, its distinct differentiations, once you are not in the middle of it, but have gained a certain distance from it. If humanity is not to have even greater woes in prospect, that distance must be achieved as quickly as possible, because at present, seen spiritually, there is a remarkable and very active contradiction. In the way I am about to portray that contradiction, it may strike you as surprisingly bizarre. There have been no other times in historically traceable human evolution that are more spiritual than the times in which we have been living since the end of the 1870s. Observed historically, we live in the most spiritual times there have ever been. And yet we live in such a way, this is undeniable, that multitudes of people who certainly deem themselves spiritual believe the present to be extremely materialistic. You see, as far as life is concerned, our age is not materialistic. According to what many people believe, and in line with all that flows from that belief, our times are certainly materialistic. So what is actually meant by saying our time is spiritual? Well, firstly, a natural scientific worldview prevails. In face of this natural scientific worldview, all previous natural scientific worldviews were materialistic. You see, we have a natural scientific world outlook that has set itself up to be among the finest, most spiritually pervaded models. The person best able to perceive this is one who can see beyond immediate physical existence. As for most of today's concepts, which, spiritually speaking, are well-intentioned, the supposedly dead have exceptionally few. They have very few. Yet of present natural scientific concepts, when impartially reflected upon, they have extraordinarily many. It is also interesting that ostensibly materialistic Darwinism is grasped and applied in highly spiritual form, in the realm of the dead. Matters transpire in life quite differently from the way in which they transpire in the belief, the often very mistaken belief, that is a result of what people experience when physically embodied here. What do I actually mean by referring, first of all, to what is natural, scientifically spiritual? Well, you see, in order to form concepts such as these, in order to soar aloft to thoughts such as those presently held about evolution and so on, requires a spirituality that was not available in earlier times. It is much easier to see ghosts and think them to be spiritual than it is to form finely chiseled ideas about what appears to be merely material. This has had the effect that people form the most spiritually suffused ideas in their soul's life, and then deny or disown those same spiritually suffused ideas. They compact those spiritually suffused ideas together, so that they are allowed solely to express aspects of materiality. The materialistic interpretation of our natural scientific world outlook is nothing other than a denial of the real nature of the natural scientific worldview. It originates in a bias that is basically cowardice. People cannot manage to make their living feelings and their delicate, spiritually permeated ideas coexist. Nor can they take hold of spirituality itself in the rarefied dilution, if I may put it like that, in which it has to be grasped if one is to form pure concepts about nature. People do not dare to admit that they live in what is spiritual, in spirit itself, when they have such spiritually rarefied, dilute concepts, and so they lie to themselves, saying these ideas only represent what is material, something untrue and just self-delusion. It is also the case in other areas of life. One could mention, for example, as I did the day before yesterday, that, for instance, many an artistic creation has benefited from these refined spiritual sensitivities coming to light in the present, advantages that were not available to earlier epochs of art evolution. It is absolutely without doubt that today in the realm of artistic creativity, much is coming to light for which one would seek in vain in Raphael or Michelangelo's art. This about-turn in spiritual life has been brought about by a specific spiritual event. It is this spiritual event that I would like to characterize for you from certain perspectives. Just before the middle of the 19th century, that is, at the start of the 1840s, a certain spiritual being, names do not add much, but so as to relate to a name, we can call this being by the name borrowed from Christian theology, the Archangel Michael. So, Michael was gradually preparing to become a time spirit, having been an archangel, aiming to attain an evolution of this kind so as to act in human life not only from the standpoint of the suprasensible, but directly from out of earthly life. The Archangel Michael was preparing to descend to earth, in a certain sense following the great deed of Christ Jesus himself, in a way re-enacting that great event. He was preparing to take up his inaugural point on earth for his onward task, now from a terrestrial perspective. It was, therefore, necessary that from the 1840s forward till the 1870s, preparations were made by and on behalf of this spiritual being. One can therefore observe how the years between the 40s and the 70s of the 19th century represent a crucial battle in the supersensible region adjoining the earth. The spiritual being we can call the Archangel Michael fought a hard and mighty battle against certain opposing adversarial spirits. We need to look at these opposing spirits a bit if we are to understand what was actually taking place. the spiritual beings to be opposed by the being evolving from archangel to time spirit, the archangel Michael, have always intervened in human life and evolution. In the millennia before the middle of the 19th century, those beings had the task of severing humanity from the spiritual world. Spiritual beings, proximate followers of archangels, cherished the aim, in a sense, of leading humanity back to being a single human group soul, to pour forth unity over all humankind. This would not have succeeded had they worked only on humanity. Humankind would have dissolved into something of an undifferentiable unit, would only have imagined as a single group, just as do the animals, only at a slightly higher level. The spiritual beings engaged in fighting Michaelic principles are those tasked with bringing differentiation into humankind, splitting a unified humanity into races, into peoples, into all manner of distinctions connected with blood, nerves, temperament, and so on. This had to take place. One can call the spiritual beings who had to effect such differentiation in humankind Ahrimanic beings. Call them this by all means. But you need to be quite clear that the intervention of the Ahrimanic principle was essential for the whole course of human evolution. Now, the time approached, an important moment in human evolution, with regard to what I have just related. The time beginning with the 1840s now arrived, and with it the ancient differentiations were to vanish. The time when differentiated humankind was to be amalgamated into a single unified humanity. Cosmopolitan views, some of which were certainly expanded into cosmopolitan phraseology in the 18th and the first half of the 19th centuries, are just a reflection of what was taking place in spiritual worlds. Human beings were already tending toward extinguishing the many and varied distinctions based around nervous disposition, blood, and temperament. It is, in fact, not an inclination of the spiritual world to further differentiate humankind, but the direction of travel, as it were, in spiritual worlds, is rather to cascade cosmopolitan values into humanity as a whole. However little understanding there is for this, under the pressures of present catastrophic times, it is nevertheless so, and the verity of this fact has to be acknowledged. This fact, which is mirrored in earthly events, leads one to see, when viewed in their spiritual context, how the spirits of races, those folk spirits differentiating humankind, were being fought from the 1840s onward specifically by that spirit who was to become time spirit for the new age. What has always been depicted in the form of a momentous symbol was in fact being fulfilled, if at a different level. That symbol is also applicable to other stages of evolution, because events tend to be repeated on various levels, and what I am now talking about is just one such repetition, at a specific stage, of other spiritual events that have taken place. It is what is symbolically portrayed as Michael's conquest over the dragon. This victory over the dragon by Michael signifies that opposing forces have been banished from the realm inhabited by Michael. And this has been fulfilled in some areas since the beginning of the 1840s onward. Certain spiritual beings, whose task in spiritual worlds had until then been to separate humanity into peoples and races, they were, if I may express it like this, cast from heaven to earth. Those same spiritual beings, who until the 1840s had been differentiating humanity into groupings, no longer exert their power today in the realm adjoining the earth. They were thrust amongst humankind on earth, bringing with them all they could. This is what in spiritual science we know as the victory of the Archangel Michael over forces of opposition, which was established at the end of the 1870s the casting down to earth of spirits combating him. What exists since the end of the 1870s is therefore twofold. On the one hand, for those of goodwill, here understood in a conditional sense, since 1879 there is the earthly sovereignty of the time spirit Michael, who enables us to grasp spiritualized concepts and to lead a spiritualized inner life. Also, to be found here on earth, are the opposing forces, forces that tempt us to negate and deny the spirituality of the present. In fighting the materialism of our times, you always need to be aware that you should not fight what benefits our times, but should be fighting against the lie of our age. For it is essentially spirits of untruth that were cast out of heaven onto earth, which presently working as spirits of obstruction, hinder spirituality from being sought in time-compatible conceptions of existence. If you come to know people who descended from spiritual worlds into earthly incarnation after 1841, and who have since died, I would say that you can indeed see how things are thought of from yonder side. You are then able to correct much of what is so difficult to access with understanding from the physical world. It gradually began to emerge at the start of the 19th century how essential it was to point to the various realms of the spirit in life. Those who did so were essentially people who since 1848, or in fact since 1840, had joined the bitterly fought battle being led by the Archangel Michael in the spiritual world, the battle which culminated in 1879 in the antithetical spirits being cast down onto earth, where they continue to exist among human beings. Basically, all opposition to these beings, all attempts to expel them from the field, entails fighting on the side of the Archangel Michael. Now, my dear friends, there is a certain law. Implicit in this law is that every point of time in evolution can be pursued in both a forward and a backward direction. When focusing on any point in humanity's historical development, one can say, here is a point in time, this or that is taking place. Now, time flows onward and one can observe subsequent events. One can also observe time in a retrograde direction. One can move from 1879 to 1878 to 1877, back to 1860, 1850, and so on further back in time. And one can then observe how in the spiritual world things can be followed in a reverse direction. The following can then be seen. One sees during such observation, embedded in the deeper structure of events and also during its progress, what lies in and as far as the background being repeated. Sometimes when something of enormity is said simply, it may sound trivial, yet I will just say it. If you focus on the point in time of 1879, you can go forward to 1880 or back to 1878. If you go ahead to 1880, you will notice in deeper spiritual structural layers that what happened in 1878, in a certain way, co-works in concert with it, works with it, such that behind the events of 1880, the event of 1878 co-reruns as a force. It is, the further back one goes, as if the line of time were to loop back on itself, so that the events lying further back relate to a given time point, and events ahead of it, by lying or running alongside them in the background. If you can grasp processes such as this, you will be understanding a great deal. Now I ask you to recall that I have been speaking about the year 1879 for many years, not just since 1914, when it became commonplace. That's important, my dear friends. And I'd ask you now to carry out a simple calculation. Work backward from 1879 to a year I have often designated as another threshold. I've always said that the battle of which I am now speaking began at the start of the 40s, around 1840 or 1841. Now, calculate backward. 1879, 69, 59, 49, plus another 8 or 9 years, which makes 38 or 39 years. Now, calculate forward. 1879, 89, 99, 1909, 1914, and onward until today, which gives us about the same, some 38 or 39 years. Were you to focus on the year 1917, you would come to a surprising conclusion. You would realize what deep significance is entailed when an occultist says, if you proceed from an incisive historical event, the preceding spiritual event finds a certain repetition in the subsequent. Behind the events of the present day, here on a physical level, stand those spiritual events which began in the 1840s, and which can be designated as the battle by the Archangel Michael against spirits of opposition. They form the backdrop. We see a recapitulation of what took place at the start of the 1840s. You can imagine how differently present events would be viewed were we to return to this lawful principle. Perhaps then, what will otherwise pass tonelessly by the human ear, without reaching the human soul, will be more profoundly understood. It could then be reflected how the Archangel Michael's battle with antagonistic forces has in some respects returned to its point of origin. By and large, it is always difficult to speak of such profound connections with people of today, because they reject so vehemently just what would help them to understand their times rightly, and hence to take appropriate action. Our time really does make it essential to let go of old prejudices and preconceptions, makes it vital to make this understandable, to bring it to consciousness. Things sometimes happen here in the immediate physical, which are, in their way, far more spiritual than many another happening. This is actually connected with the descent of the Archangel Michael into our earthly realm. Many speak of this Michaelic descent into our earthly domain. But when this fact, in all the significance of its true background, actually comes to it, people don't want to align themselves with it. They just don't want to take it up. Yet it is enormously important that in ever-widening circles, a spiritual understanding of the most important impulses of our lifetimes takes hold. That is why what has been continuing in our branch meetings for years on end has been absolutely indispensable in drawing attention to the fact that the stream of events so strongly influenced by the Spirit in our times should not be slept through. This sleeping through events is such a feature of our times. People pass events by as if comatose. It could even be stated that the more trenchantly decisive the event on the physical plane, the deeper and greater its significance, the more soundly will people sleep through it. If I may just hint at something in concrete terms, March 1917 was one such momentous period as regards its potential, one that will have consequences of which humanity can barely dream today, and it is positively appalling how little people understand the imperative that almost every opinion and judgment be revised. Almost everything that people ever believed before 1914 needs to undergo complete revision. This may be the occasion to draw attention to the fact that in 1910 in Christiania, I held a series of lectures about European folk souls. In the first of these, you can read that in the near future humanity would be called upon to have some understanding of the relationships between European folk souls. It was repeatedly emphasized in those lectures that our gaze ought to be directed toward the immediate East, that what emanates from that area is of importance for human evolution. How often was this said? Everyone present can attest to it. And again in the lecture cycle in Vienna in spring 1914, I dared to suggest that the social life of the present can, in a very real sense, be compared with a form of illness, with a carcinoma, and that a cancer-like sickness was creeping throughout social life. Obviously, such things cannot, under our present circumstances, be described any differently, but they must be understood. World events are not turning out to be that fabled progression of which historians dream, that the subsequent always evolves out of the previous, this from that, and so on. To assume that the subsequent will emerge as quietly as possible of its own accord, or at least that it ought to, can be left to people with less grasp of reality than the thinking anthroposophist ought to have developed. If I am to hint at something concrete, this assumption can largely be left to politicians of the old school, as indeed to those of the present, for as long as humanity wants to. In reality, it is a matter of something quite different. It is a case of the course of events being like the beam of a set of scales in full alternating tilt, where now this pan, now the other, sinks downward. That is why one can characterize the period since the 1840s something like this. There would have been opportunities in the period between the years of 1840 and 1914, a time span bisected by the year 1879, had there been appropriate and timely attempts to prepare for the spiritualizing of humanity, which is the aim of the Archangel Michael. Had there been attempts on a larger scale to introduce spiritual concepts, spiritual ideas, to humanity. If free human will neglects to do this, because freedom has to hold sway among modern human beings, then the scales will dip to the opposite side. Then what could have been achieved by spiritual means will be discharged through blood. It will then be discharged by what I'd like to call supra-physical means. What we are experiencing in these catastrophic times is only the rebalancing of the scales. Humanity, having refused spiritualization, will then be compelled into spiritualization. This may be achieved by means of physical catastrophes. You can confirm this idea for yourselves, if you are firmly grounded, as in what follows. We live here in this physical world, but we are awake only as far as our perceptions and conceptions are concerned, as I recently explained. Here we dream with our feelings and are fast asleep as regards our will, something natural for human beings. However, if you find your way into yonder world through imagination, intuition, and inspiration, into the spiritual world surrounding us, just as air surrounds us here, and in which the seemingly dead and their incentives of will exist in community with us, then you will perceive how our lives in the physical are interwoven with those of the apparently deceased. Those dead can absorb from our human hearts only the spiritual element among our conceptual images. Remember what I said 3 days ago. Seen spiritually, when a younger person dies, they have not taken leave of those belonging to them. They remain. They are in reality there. Yet for the deceased it is quite different from just being there. I beg you to take this very seriously. For the deceased it is a matter of bearing that existence, being able to encompass it. If the deceased is present in a family which is materialistically minded and not given to spiritual ideas, though they remain within that family, the deceased will be continuously burdened and oppressed. The family is for them like a nightmare, where excessively inhaling air can cause nightmares. Only spiritual ideas can banish these nightmares for the deceased and make coexisting with those near to whom they remain bearably possible. I also said to you earlier, when an older person is torn from those belonging to them, they to some extent take the souls of their adherents with them. They draw them along with themselves. They draw them in train. And here too, if people are not suffused with spiritual ideas, It is like a nightmare for the deceased. Let us now consider something else. You can learn an enormous amount if you observe when a person dies very suddenly, whether caused by external agency or abnormal inner states. Let us imagine that a person is hit or shot. A death such as this is quite different from one ending a long illness or other natural processes. Imagine someone aged 35 is shot, their life annihilated by external agency. Had the bullet not hit them, this is certainly connected with their karma, but the following nevertheless applies. The person concerned may well have lived a further 35 years according to their constitution. You see, their constitution might have granted them a further 35 years, and this has a specific effect. If someone dies violently, while they still contain markedly vigorous life forces, they experience a tremendous amount at that very moment. Compressed into one moment, they experience what would otherwise have stretched ahead over a long time span. What they might have experienced over that further period of, say, 35 years, whatever life would have been apportioned to them over that time, is compressed into a single moment. This is because the most important realization one comes to in the hour of death is to view one's corporeality from outside, how it makes the transition from being ruled by forces it previously possessed, when their soul still inhabited their body, to the present situation, where their soul becomes a being of nature and is given over to the forces of nature, to external physical forces. That is the most tremendously significant aspect of the moment of dying. When the human being looks back on how their organism is delivered up to physical forces of nature, when someone undergoes a violent death, they are not only surrendered to normal natural forces, but due, for instance, to the sudden bullet wound, are treated like an inorganic and inert object, totally transposed into the realm of the inorganic. There is a huge difference whether one sickens and dies or whether one experiences death by being abruptly dispatched, in which case the universe intervenes externally in the organism, be it in the form of a bullet or other means. Then what happens is an instant illumination, a blaze of infinite spirituality. It is the flaring over of a spiritual aura that takes place. The person who has gone through the gate of death looks back at this flaring up, at a blazing forth that is very similar to what only comes about when human beings devote themselves in thought to spiritual concepts. These phenomena are mutually interchangeable. From the other side, from the perspective of the deceased, it is incredibly interesting to see how similar are the thoughts, those feeling, felt, sentient thoughts, of someone looking at, enjoying, or creating a work of art or a painting that is born out of spiritual insight, with those experienced when, without it going via human consciousness, let's say an arm is injured or pain arises in a person. There is an extraordinary kinship between both these phenomena, such that each can stand in for the other. Now, you will understand the karmic connection existing between two events. As the 1840s approached, of course a large number of people knew what I might call the, quote, state of the stars, close quote, which is just a technical term among occultists wishing to denote an event such as the battle of the Archangel Michael with the dragon, with the expression, quote, that is the state of the stars, close quote. Anyway, there were a whole number of people who knew at that time that a process as vital as this was taking place. There were also people who cared, who wanted to take positive, preemptive measures. It was just that the pans of the scales, as it were, had been too heavily weighted against them. That is, the materialistic bent of people was too strong. Instead, people reached for the most false sources possible at the time. It was realized that spiritual life needed to enter human existence. Had this spiritual life entered humanity in the early 1840s, humankind would have been spared many disasters. Despite this, what took place would anyway have come about, just in a different manner. Because whatever is karmically necessary will take place, but can do so by a variety of means. You must always bear this firmly in mind. I will express myself even more clearly. If a person today thinks about what should happen in the social arena, or indeed anywhere else, they can do this in one of two ways. They can set up a program, create programmatic concepts, think up ways the world ought to work in a given field. All this can be turned into a pleasant-sounding wordage. You can swear by this wordage, as if it were dogma, but nothing, absolutely nothing, will result. You can have the nicest ideas about how things should work out. Nothing can result. Nothing actually needs to come of many a nice idea. Thought out, thought up programs are the very most useless things in life. Alternatively, you can do something else, and some people manage this without added clairvoyance. You can ask yourself quite naively, with just an intuitive grasp of the conditions of the time, quote, what will in any event happen in the next 20 or 30 years? What exists in our time that longs to be actualized? Once you have identified this, you will be able to tell what will anyway happen. Now you have a choice. Either you will use reason to direct progress in the direction it will anyway take, then things will turn out well. Or you ignore this and fail to do anything, letting the matter depend on what presently exists. You sleep, you do not awake, and the issue is resolved through catastrophes or revolutions, cataclysms, disasters, or similar will then follow. No statistics, no prefabricated program, however cleverly thought out, will then be of any use. The only thing of value will be observing what lies in the lap of the times. This is what has to be taken up, what needs to be fathomed. This is what must govern the intentions of the present. In the 1840s, most people were of the programming ilk, and outweighed those who understood what I have just described. Because of this, all sorts of measures were used to spiritualize humanity, for instance, spiritualism, which is just an attempt to spiritualize people by improper means, to reform them by materialistic means, by trying to manifest the spiritual world in lifelike forms. One can be very materialistic in one's thinking. One is materialistic if one maintains this or that section of humanity is in the right, so why doesn't the spiritual world step in on the side of righteousness? How often have we heard that nowadays? Why don't these spiritual powers intervene? I replied in slightly abstract Maine recently. Humanity is grounded in freedom today. Those who continue to ask why spiritual powers don't intervene proceed from the belief that ghosts ought to run politics instead of human beings. It would indeed make for easy progress were ghosts instead of humans to bring in reforms. That would make a real difference. They cannot, of course, do this because people are grounded in freedom. Waiting for ghosts is what confuses people most, and it diverts them from what actually needs to happen. So it is precisely the time for people, in accordance with their lives, to work their way into the refined spiritual ideas that live so clearly in some. Yet, on the other hand, it is also a time in which people are susceptible to the most powerful materialistic temptations. People simply cannot distinguish between refined spiritual concepts and the tempting impressions that approach them, undermining their perception of the spirituality they contain, of what has been spiritualized, of what itself constitutes genuine spirituality. Because, at the crucial time, people failed to grasp how evolution had to progress, it has necessarily resulted in the catastrophically bitter age in which we now find ourselves. In the absence of this terribly disastrous present, humanity would have sunk even deeper into disbelief in itself. All the more would it have reached a point where spirituality would, albeit, have developed but been all the more strongly rejected. Such is some background to history in the making. I would so much like to throw light on what lies in the foreground, but for reasons easily understood, that cannot be done, particularly at the moment. It must be left to each individual to illuminate the foreground, what is living in their immediate present, on the basis of these backgrounds. That somnolence, that sleeping through events, which I described earlier, conditions us to prefer to overlook life's sharper corners and contours, and this includes inwardly. Ignoring life's sharp corners and contours involves compromise. Now, there can be times when compromise is called for. What went on in the 40s of the 19th century was one such instance to which compromise would have been well suited. But our present time is not. It sets us the task of seeing things as they really are, complete with their sharpest corners and contours. Yet it also implants in human nature the urge to close our eyes sleepily to the sharp corners and contours that exist in life. Particularly in face of the greatest, most significant events in human evolution, can what I have just described be observed. In face of the greatest event in world history, human evolution has brought humanity to these harsh corners and contours, especially the very greatest event in world history, the mystery of Golgotha. We know what theological developments of the 19th century have contributed. From the time when Lessing spoke about the mystery of Golgotha to that of the philosopher Drews, all sorts of perspectives have been discussed. One could say the whole theological debate of the 19th century offers the most fulsome proof that we have totally unlearned even the most initial understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. Yet there are some very interesting publications about Christ Jesus. For instance, a Danish one, written completely from the standpoint of a modern natural scientific thinker. This person says of his point of view, "I am a psychologist, a physiologist, a psychiatrist, and I view the Gospels from this perspective." What did he conclude? In line with current psychiatric thinking and constructs, the man concluded, "The image which the Gospels create of Christ Jesus is one of pathology. One can only encompass Christ Jesus in terms of a being constituted of mania, epilepsy, pathological visions, and so forth. All the symptoms of an acutely mentally ill person are present." When I read out parts of this book recently, people were horrified. That is understandable. If people are faced with what they hold sacred being described in terms of pathological symptoms, they are outraged. But what is this actually? What is being presented is that, among large numbers of disingenuous concession granters, one has raised their head above the parapet who stands full square within the natural scientific mode of thinking, one who no longer makes compromises, but instead says, "I am utterly a natural scientist. And because that is what I am, I have to say things as I do, because it is a fact." Were people to be honest enough to put themselves into the standpoint occupied by natural science, they would have to acquire perspectives such as these. Here there are sharp corners and contours, and one cannot do otherwise. Nor can one do other than either vacate the natural scientific standpoint and migrate to spiritual science. One would then be remaining honest. Or one can remain honestly within the natural scientific mindset, in which case one must be uncompromising and only view things as does this hide-bound man who is honest in his field. He is at least thoroughly hide-bound and does not whitewash his bigotry, is narrow-minded but consistently so. You have to put yourself in their position. Were people nowadays to appreciate what certain nuances necessitate when they arise illuminatingly, only then would they begin to see life without compromise. An interesting pamphlet was recently passed to me. I knew about the book mentioned in it, but do not have it with me, so I can only read the leaflet. It was slipped to me to illustrate what is possible today. Quote, "Whoever has burdened the benches of a grammar school will be unable to forget the hours spent enjoying," in quotes, "the platonic conversations between Socrates and his friends. Unforgettable for the fabulous boredom those discussions engendered. Maybe one remembers that one found those Socratic conversations wholeheartedly stupid. But of course one never dared to express that view, because after all the man in question was, quote, the greatest philosopher, close quote, Socrates." Close quote. With his quite unjustified overestimation of the worthy Athenian, the book titled Socrates the Idiot by Alexander Motzkowski is quite properly tidied up and rounded off. In this small and entertaining work, the polyhistor Motzkowski undertakes nothing less than stripping Socrates almost entirely of his philosophic virtue. The title Socrates the Idiot is intended literally. You will not go astray in assuming that scientific debate will ensue in connection with this book. You may find it awful that things of this sort are written. Isn't that so? But I don't find it awful at all. I think it obvious and honest of Motzkowski. Because according to his concepts and percepts, he can, if he is consistent, call Socrates an idiot. That is clear. In doing so, he is more honest than countless others who ought, in line with their views, also to call Socrates an idiot, but who do not do so out of sheer equivocation. Needless to say, I trust that it would not be spread abroad, through the porous walls of the Munich branch, that I have declared myself in agreement with Motzkowski when he calls Socrates an idiot. I would hope you understand what I actually mean. However, I must also acknowledge that nowadays some opinions only percolate into human sensitivities because dishonest compromises are made. One cannot simultaneously think about mental illness in the way modern psychiatry thinks, and not write a book such as the Dane wrote about Christ Jesus. It cannot be done. One is not being honest if one either fails to reject such concepts and replace them with spiritual concepts, or aligns oneself squarely with the view that Christ Jesus was mentally ill. Nor can one, knowing all this, if one knows Alexander Motzkowski's idiosyncratic views on radiation or quantum theory, one just has to be conversant with such people and remain abreast of their views on remote concepts, on the entire fabric of the universe. Avoid calling Socrates and Plato idiots, that is, if one is to be thoroughly consistent and consequential. Motivation exceptionally useful to humankind includes, above all this, that we reject compromise, that we do not make compromises, at least and for a start, not in our minds. It is important, extremely important, to see this as an obligation of our time. Because it is among the most vital impulses of the time spirit, Michael, to cascade clarity, unconditional clarity, into human souls. If one wants to follow the Archangel Michael, then it is essential to inundate human souls with clarity, with lucidity, in order to overcome all sleepiness. Drowsiness can arise in other fields too, but it is an absolutely prime requirement to make clear the consequences of any given issue. This was different in times gone by. In previous ages, before the age of Michael, when European humanity was essentially governed by Gabriel, it was the case that what people here considered compromise was already being weakened by spiritual worlds. Michael is the spirit who, in the most preeminent sense, works with human freedom. Michael, therefore, does what is right. You must not believe that Michael does not do what is right. He absolutely does do what is right. In the unconscious regions of every human soul today, those sharp corners and contours of spiritual life can be found. They are already there. Even those individuals who have the slightest, and be it only the very slightest, facility to raise to surface consciousness what exists in the subterranean recesses of soul life by way of latent vision, know how much discrepancy and disparate non-cohesion prevails there. They know that a materialistic psychiatry that does not shy away from seeing in them epileptics, even from diagnosing Christ Jesus as such, can coexist cheek by jowl in souls. They know that. If things rise to consciousness even a little, if someone only has a slight ability to raise things to consciousness, then they will be aware how matters stand. It would be interesting to see how a modern painter with a sense of present predicaments might paint, quote, Christ from the perspective of a psychiatrist, close quote. How what is happening today might be brought to expression. It would be really interesting if a painter had some understanding of what presently goes on in those subterranean recesses of soul life. You see, you have to dig deep in our times to understand what is taking place on the surface of existence. On the other hand, people are recognizably overcome by a certain cowardice, a lack of courage, when trying to approach what has just been described. And that is the other quality required in the present. Courage, even a degree of audacity in one's outlook, in one's way of thinking, the sort of audacity that doesn't blunt concepts but instead tends to make them as pointedly acute as possible. I have said all this so that, inasmuch as they are spiritually accessible, anyone can themselves observe them. It is quite possible to observe these traits yourself if you really wish to examine spiritual life in the present. Everything that has had to be said today can be confirmed by outer events. The spiritual researcher will merely present it more precisely because they can see its corresponding spiritual background. And if you receive from the spiritual researcher background facts such as these, you will be all the more able to see the veracity proved of what has, for example, been indicated today. A few people asked me today what they should actually do. What they ought to do lies immediately to hand. One would like to say, just open your eyes, albeit your spiritual eyes. The will for action will follow from opening your eyes. Will often depends on the location in which you are placed. It's not always possible to do what is right in accordance with your karma in the place in which you find yourself. But you should try to open your eyes spiritually. Nowadays, it is often the case that when trying to introduce something in the form of words, something essential for the present, people tend to rapidly close their eyes before equally rapidly turning away from the thrust of what is being said. Such is just the weighting of the scales toward the other extremity. Speaking in this way could easily be taken as criticism of the times. That is never my intention. What I intend is to draw wakeful attention to the impulses flowing from the spiritual world into human souls, to what has to flow into human feelings if we want to emerge from the catastrophic times in which we find ourselves. As I said, it is unfortunately not possible to go into concrete details. Everyone can do this for themselves. The end of Lecture 10.